thing is, to use the term pro or anti-American still implies that you're defining the world in terms of us, as if the rest of the world's primary definition is how they relate to us. But the whole point of all of these data and all of these numbers about how the world is changing is to say it isn't about us.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, author and scholar Parag Khanna talks about his new book. It's called The Second World. Khanna believes that America's dominant moment is over, and the U.S. must look to regions like Eastern Europe, Latin America, and the Middle East for energy and resources. But the U.S. has competition, says Khanna. He argues that America must compete with the European Union and China to shape world order. He says each of the big three must court second world nations, many of which teeter precariously on the boundary of the third world. Their fates and those of the big three, he says, are intertwined. This discussion of the second world was recorded in March of 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you so much to everyone for coming. It's a real honor to be here. I was telling Carla earlier, this is the store I've been sort of coming into and just sort of sitting in the back or between the stacks since freshman year of college. And I can't believe I actually get to stand on this side of the audience for the first time. It's a real honor. So the book has only been out about a week, so I can't imagine many people have any sort of experience with it. It does cover a lot of ground, literally, in terms of mileage racked up. And, you know, rather than try to summarize everything, which I, you know, certainly won't be able to do, I think that some of the themes are worth exploring in a bit more depth. And the term that I use to capture this, sort of paradigm shift is what I call the non-American world. How do you make real the data that you read in the papers about Asian economies and Europe trying to decouple from the United States, the demographic shifts and the rise of Asia and what a small percentage of the global population we represent, the notion that foreign diplomatic institutions are emerging in Asia and Central Asia and elsewhere that kind of more or less exclude us. When you add it all up, what do you get? To a lot of people, it's, well, is the world becoming anti-American? Is it post-American, as other people say? The thing is, to use the term pro or anti-American still implies that you're defining the world in terms of us, as if the rest of the world's primary definition is how they relate to us. But the whole point of all of these data and all of these numbers about how the world is changing is to say it isn't about us. So the only term I could come up with is to emphasize the point to us, to an American audience, is non-American. And I wanted to travel not as an American. I wanted this to be a book for anyone, whether a Chinese person, a European, an American, to understand what is happening. And only at the end of the book do I really focus a lot on just America. What does it mean for America? What is America's role in the world? And so on. Because, of course, at the end of the day, I am an American writing in English, and most of the books are going to be. But I really wanted to emphasize as much as possible that you can travel, see the world from the inside out, from the eyes of dozens of countries, and not define yourself in terms of America. I think that alone was one motivation for doing this. But there was another one, and that other motivation was geopolitical and almost academic. You can anywhere here in this store find books that were written 5 to 10 years ago that said, China will dominate the 21st century. America, step aside. You can also find books that say, Europe sets the world standards. Europe is the better place to be. The European Union is expanding. They're richer and better than us. America, step aside. And then you've got books on the same shelf that say, America is the sole dominant hegemon of the 21st century. The 21st century will still be America's. Everyone else is sort of, you know, tyrannical or useless. And you've got those books. But last time I checked, we still all live on one planet. And therefore, these ideas do somehow need to be reconciled. You know, you could have debates in Brussels or Washington or Beijing till you're blue in the face about who's number one, who's doing the best, who's got the best strategy. But what I tried to do was spend as little time as possible here. And for most of 2005 and 2006 and a little bit beyond that, I just packed up and kind of went and to these second world countries and tried to explore sort of, you know, who was really winning, who has the most influence, and where are we winning, where are we losing. which is not to say it's zero sum, because in a globalized world it doesn't necessarily have to be. But I did find that you can no longer, and you can imagine sort of, you know, maybe Dick Cheney's map on the wall or somewhere in the Pentagon where it's sort of, you've got Japan and other countries, you've got an American flag on them. Like, these are our allies, these are our friends, this is where we have power and so forth in a very risk board kind of way. I found the picture to be obviously much more subtle. I found that we don't really have a single, very few really, if any, true, genuine allies in the sense that they would do anything for us. I found more countries saying, whatever you guys do, don't expect us to be involved. So yes, we'll have a defense agreement with you and we'll take your money, but we're not going to stand shoulder to shoulder with you. And that's also part of this, again, non-American world, because countries are defining their own future, looking for their own path to success, and that doesn't have to be an American path or one allied with the United States. Instead, what we have is a geopolitical marketplace, one in which America isn't the only superpower empire offering packages of incentives to countries to be their friends, to win their alliances, to win their loyalty, and so forth. Instead, there is a European model for doing that, and it works most certainly in the countries that in the last 15 years have become European, which is about 15 countries. Almost one per year on average has become a member of the European Union. That's no mean feat, and Europe's relations and influence is expanding in its periphery and sort of spreading outward. And China has its own way of building influence and is doing so all over the world, forming alliances. And what you have, again, is not the risk board of this one's ours, we've lost this one, they've got a foothold here, how are we going to counter it there? It's this overlapping picture of America, China, Europe being influential at the same time in the same country, with the second world countries being the most shrewd, and that's why I focus on them in the book, being the most shrewd at not aligning with one or being neutral, but what I call multi-aligning. They play all sides off each other. So Egypt will take more investment from Europe than before, but continue to take assistance from the United States while spending our money on Chinese weapons. You know, Iran will take assistance from Russia and its nuclear program, a lot of money selling oil to China, and keep stringing the Europeans along in the nuclear negotiations to keep getting the investment and hold us off. There's a lot of this kind of thing going on in this multi-aligning world in which no one seems to be friends or permanent friends or permanent enemies with anyone at the same time. Everyone is kind of out for themselves. And globalization really makes it possible for countries to sustain that kind of behavior rather than the Cold War model of you're with us or you're with the other guy. So I wanted to paint the picture of this sort of flux, which we don't necessarily have the power to change, because the fundamental reality of the world, again, isn't American power or American dominance, but this globalization that has really spun out of any one power's control, and certainly ours. Diffusion of technology puts power in the hands of just about anyone who wants it, and certainly the power to deny us certain things, which is really all that some peoples may need to achieve their objective, to sort of fend us off. So those are some of the trends that I saw all over the world. But again, I took a very aesthetic approach. I wanted to not do it in a wonky sort of, you know, political scientist way, since I'm not formally fully finished with my political science training anyway. I wanted to do it as a traveler. I've been traveling my whole life, and I just needed to convince my publisher to pay for me to keep doing it nonstop for a couple more years. And I succeeded at that, if nothing else. And so it was through those couple of years of just interviewing and talking to anyone and everyone I could in all of these different places that I came to this sort of, you know, overall macro kind of picture. And to me, it's so real because I did spend so much time there. It wasn't about public opinion surveys, and I don't think I really even necessarily cite any. It is, to some extent, impressionistic. But I think, again, it's also, these are also arguments that are backed up by a lot of research that people do on these specific regions that I traveled in. But I want to talk about why I call the book The Second World. Some of you may remember that the Second World used to mean the socialist world and, you know, the Soviet Union plus Warsaw Pact countries and so on. But of course, that concept more or less disappeared after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But we still say there's a first world. We still talk about rich first world countries in a socioeconomic sense. And we talk about the third world, poor, backwards, whatever you want to call it, sort of countries. We use these broad labels that are very fluid. And I decided that what a second world country is not a country that's halfway in between. It's not just sort of on this straight line, maybe slow or fast path towards becoming a developed, modern, democratic, liberal state like us or Europeans, but rather it's this very, very unstable condition of being both third world and first world at the same time. And globalization creates all these opportunities for development that some countries or some parts of some countries exploit, while the rest of the country sort of lags behind. And this division within countries is one of the most intriguing, puzzling, disturbing, in a way, phenomenon that you find now wherever you travel. And I think everyone can sympathize with this experience. How many of you have traveled to countries in Latin America or the Middle East or East Asia and said, wow, you know, in the cities it was great, but in the rest of the country I couldn't get running water and the roads were so bad and so on. That's what's happening everywhere in the entire world. And the challenge of governance, the challenge of running a country, is closing those gaps. And there aren't many countries that are doing it all that well at this point in time. That causes certain instabilities within countries that I also wanted to explore and challenges. And I found that unless you understand what the tipping point is internally, what is it that causes the Chavez phenomenon to happen in Venezuela, and what causes regime change or domestically or electoral change in Iran and elsewhere, those are often domestic factors, not foreign ones. But they have a huge impact on the foreign policies of those countries and therefore on us. Specifically, look at Iran and Venezuela and what a challenge they pose for the U.S. In some of these cases, it results or it shocks us because we're not paying enough attention to what happens on the inside, and only by going and spending time in these countries, and I believe the second world countries are sort of the most strategic ones, do we get a sense of what it is that these societies want and need, what are their problems. And so I wanted to tell the story from the inside out, because only if you understand them on their own terms, understand their geography, their history, their society, their culture, their place, where they see themselves, where they want to be, are we going to be able to craft the policies that can sort of win influence in those places. So in a way, what I wanted to subtitle the book, not Empires and Influence, the New Global Order, but How to Win Allies and Influence Countries, you know, in the 21st century. Because I think that that's really what I sort of set out to do, is to create that understanding for us of them so that we can have a better kind of guidebook or sort of playbook in foreign policy. You know, a lot of people say that this will have to wait till the next administration. People ask, well, what's your guidance for Obama or Hillary or whomever? You know, I remember learning in school that foreign policy was supposed to be about national interest and a certain sense of continuity, not partisanship, and I never thought in those kind of terms. Obviously, that was sort of naive and utopian, but I'd like to think that these are things that we should be thinking about right now and not waiting for the next administration to come in. So I'm hoping at least to stimulate something of a conversation about some of these critical countries in the world that we're not paying attention to until it's often too late. And so those were the various sort of, you know, motivations that I had. But if you like, I can stop right there and we can just have a discussion about...
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Latin America. And obviously we speak a lot about China, India, Iran, Europe as our counterbalances. And everybody knows about Chavez. But increasingly, I think we're seeing more leaders in Bolivia and Ecuador, increasingly Chile relations with Argentina, viable leftist candidate in Paraguay. I wonder if you could tell us what you think this means, how you think it'll play out, and what the United States ought to do to improve our own interests or to advance our interests.
The Latin America question is a fascinating one. I had to fight and argue to keep the Latin America section in my book because it's considered so geopolitically irrelevant, and it's just this sort of neglected feature in geopolitics and American foreign policy. I really wanted to keep it in because of the fact that with globalization, Latin America's vast natural resources are available and more efficiently deliverable to the global market than ever before. And China is moving into the region and creating a certain trade alliance with not least Brazil is a good example of this. And that also has empowered, to some extent, although the two aren't necessarily related, but the desire to play in the geopolitical marketplace has, to some extent, empowered people like Hugo Chavez to sort of stand up and talk about a Bolivarian revolution continent-wide, sponsor leftist movements across and so forth. There's a permissive environment for that when there is widespread resentment towards America as a sort of bully. And of course, leftist movements in Latin America are very cyclical kind of a phenomenon. So they probably would have happened and come back anyway. But the opportunity in all of this is that if you look really big picture, we are trying to, or at least everyone is saying, the one thing that all sides in America and the American political spectrum can agree on is we want energy interdependence. We want to be more competitive economically with Asia and all these kinds of things. The answer to almost all of our problems is in our own hemisphere and in our own backyard. You want energy interdependence. You want to develop the resources, you know, from Canada on down through Mexico. Brazil has more energy now. You want to have good relations with Venezuela and so on. You can be less dependent on Middle East oil than ever before if you think about our own hemisphere and the resources here. You want competitiveness with Asia? Well, then think back to the 1950s and 60s when the U.S. had an alliance for progress and helped develop the industries of Brazil, Argentina, and all these countries and help them industrialize and become, in Brazil's example, this sort of steel exporting sort of juggernaut that it is. We need to go back to that. If you want lower cost and efficient productive production centers that are be leaving the United States, but you want to have a stronger relationship with those countries, then you need to integrate economically more with Latin America rather than less and create that kind of positive cycle of development, job creation, industrialization, exports that is American-sponsored. And then you will have better relations with Latin American countries and a more competitive America and potentially a regionally sort of mutually self-sufficient and prosperous sort of Western Hemisphere. So for all those reasons, I realize that Latin America, which everyone is ignoring, is absolutely central to geopolitics and our future.
Hi. When I was a teacher in San Francisco in the 30 years ago, we taught, you know, Chinua Achebe, things fall apart. We taught from a different perspective. And so the first question I have is, what do you think we should do so that young people learn this and also so that, you know, United States citizens learn this? Because we are so America-centric. Second question is, it's very interesting that you say we should really begin now before the next election to start thinking this way. And I just wonder, how do you think we should go about this?
Okay, first question on sort of, you know, I don't think your question was just really about education, actually. It's sort of the waking up to the recognition that we already are very dependent on the international economy. We need foreign direct investment. We need now sovereign wealth funds to bail out our banks and so on and so forth. So, you know, just reading the news alone should, within this framework that I'm trying to lay out, have people understand just how integrated we are and need to be, and rather than being completely sort of, you know, U.S.-centric. But a lot of the conclusion of the book is dedicated to exploring whether or not we're still number one at all. In what ways are we becoming like a second world country? And it's fairly, I guess, controversial, even though all I do is really just go through OECD indicators of our health standards, our life expectancy, our quality of healthcare, education, so on and so on and so on. And I just show how we've slipped from, you know, maybe top three or four in the world in certain categories down into, you know, the low or high teens and 20s in certain areas. And so quality of life in America doesn't necessarily quite stack up the way it used to. And education is certainly one component of that. But you can still live your life perfectly happily in America without owning a passport, you know. And so there's this cliche out there, like, can you believe only half of Americans have a passport or something? I think that's it's actually rather quaint. I mean, I think that's really great. America is very lucky like that. You know, you don't have to be a small European country surrounded by larger countries with whom you've been fighting wars for centuries. I'd say we're pretty, you know, well off and fortunate in that way. So I think that to posit that each American should know three foreign languages and have traveled. I know you didn't, but I just think that it's always going to be an uphill climb because we are so unique and geographically kind of distant. I like what didn't Princeton just announce that it wants 10% of its incoming class to defer admission and go travel for a year and do international development work and projects? It was an article in the paper last week. I think that's really great. I'd like to see a lot more of that happening. Civil service in general is something that doesn't exist in a structured national way. Clinton tried in the early 90s. It was a, you know, terrible political failure. But in Europe, it's more or less mandatory in every country, and sometimes it is even done overseas. So this culture of civil service, even international service, that gets people out there. You know, we have a Peace Corps, but it's actually very small. We could afford and deploy a Peace Corps 10 times the size that we have it, or much, much larger than that. And I think we should be doing things like this. And it has all kinds of beneficial spin-off effects. People getting educated, people learning foreign languages, understanding foreign societies. You can generate better policy that way, and so on and so on and so on.
And starting to change things now before the election?
Oh, boy. I mean, good question. No, look, the time to start was yesterday. I mean, the fact is, if we are a superpower and believe that we are a global leader, have global responsibilities, should be involved in solving problems everywhere and have not been, and so it's a problem that has nothing to do with our election cycle. It has to do with how we structure our diplomacy, what our vision is for the world, aligning it with rising powers, attempting to accommodate them now rather than when conflicts arise. So this is a much bigger question than our election. I really believe that we are, you know, failing to be a respectable superpower.
I challenge the use of the term superpower. We have infatuated ourselves with the term superpower. We're not. If you look at other countries in the world, they're not superpowers. If you look at Japan, an aging society that does not allow immigration. If you look at China, superfluous building, you go into the rural areas, poverty. My question to you is on how the United States can rise at this point above any of the other powers. We are equal with them.
Sure. Yeah, in a way, that's sort of the point of the book. The term superpower simply means, you know, that entity, empire, country, whatever it may be, that is capable of shaping events and decisions that are made all over the world in the furthest corners. And the fact is that Europe has an influence on Latin American economies, on a huge influence on African economies. In every corner of the world, there's European economic, political influence. And increasingly, the same thing goes for China, and it certainly goes for us. It doesn't apply to Russia anymore, not necessarily Japan, not India. That's why, as a literal definitional point, Europe, China, and America are, in fact, superpowers. America may militarily, of course, be, you know, one rung above that. So some say we're a hyperpower. But that doesn't mean that others aren't superpowers.
Hi. I would like you to comment on two things. The first is the role that the U.S. has in helping or backing up the independence of Kosovo, a little bit against European wills or agenda. And the second, which is more general, maybe it's if you can comment on the nature of Europe being like dual nature, as they behave as an entity economically, right. But then every country chooses their alliances and then change a lot from time to time. Right. And if this can help or not help Europe in.
Yeah, no, those are great questions. Kosovo, you know, it's not that Europe did not want it to be independent. It's just that Europe doesn't want to provoke Serbia to intervene militarily and for there to be conflict and to antagonize Russia. So in a way, they're very just conservative in their approach to it. And America is, of course, much more aggressive, if you will. But personally, I think, you know, we did the right thing there. What Europe's goal, though, is to not just have sprout lots of little independent countries, but to make them all members of the EU eventually, such that it doesn't matter. And it's called not state building or nation building, but member state building is kind of the clever term that some Europeans have for it. So you've got a country like Bosnia emerging from conflict. It doesn't have its own currency. It used this convertible mark, which was German. And my argument in this book is its next currency should just be the euro. You know, European member states don't really need their own currencies. They're European. And that's what Europe is trying to get to, this postmodern imperial kind of form. It succeeded in a lot of ways, again, beyond most people's wildest imaginations. But in each and every case, you know, there's obviously a lot of hiccups and challenges. You know, we always look at Europe in very condescendingly here in the U.S. and we say, because it's not a unitary state with, you know, Kissinger said, who do I call when I want Europe's foreign policy? And we still don't necessarily have that answer. Does that mean Europe has failed? Hardly. You know, it has a supranational component in Brussels, but it also has 27 different foreign policies at the same time. My argument, though, is that much of what individual European countries do on their own, even without consulting Brussels, ultimately benefits Europe. You know, and one easy example of that is the fact that between Spain and Italy, their energy companies have been building gas pipelines from Libya and Algeria in the past years, and there's one or two pipelines coming up every couple of years. It's not just exclusively for Italy or for Spain. I mean, this energy goes into the broader European market, and it serves over the very long term, as well as through their relations increasingly with the Persian Gulf, to diminish that overwhelming dependence that they have on Russia right now. So Europeans do things individually that ultimately serve the sort of common good. And that's their approach. We have to understand it on their terms rather than just arguing that because there isn't one President Bush that... Yeah, exactly. So there you go.
Hi. What's your view on Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilization? Does it, his view still hold good now?
You said, is it still valid Clash of Civilizations? I think you're implying that it ever was valid. I certainly don't think it ever was valid to begin with. So I try to basically dismiss the entire argument in one sentence in the beginning of my book. I say empires, which is what this book is about, are bigger than civilizations because empires like Europe and like China span across civilizations and they're integrating and subsuming diverse cultures and civilizations sort of, you know, within them. China is sort of expanding westward, for example, in its influence at least, not territorially, literally, and bringing in Turkic Muslim populations and so forth, and is creating this broader imperial zone. That appears to be a more powerful force than the force of a sort of culturally defined civilization, such as Islam, which is your other question. Islam is not a coherent civilization. You can say Islamic bomb, but I don't think that Saudi Arabia feels protected because Pakistan has a nuclear weapon, even though there was Saudi, you know, involvement in it, and nor does Egypt and nor do others. So if you want to say that Islam is a civilizational coherent superpower, you need to give me one example where all Muslim countries simultaneously decide to do something. When is that ever going to happen? You know, quite literally never, as far as I can tell. So it's not a superpower. But, you know, in geopolitics, there is, unlike in international relations or sort of, you know, realist international relations where you think about just states and power and interests, in geopolitical thinking, there is room to think about ideology and the sort of, you know, motivational power that can have. And there are people who think about that coalescence that you're wondering, you know, whether it will take shape. But it's really not there yet.
So it seems like a lot of people on the left have been, you know, say Emanuel Wallerstein or something, have been talking about the end of U.S. hegemony for 30 years. And sort of what makes your book a big breakthrough is it's the first mass consumption foreign policy book, if that's not an oxymoron, to be saying that. But I think a lot of people have pointed out that no state has ever ceded power gracefully.
Right.
How dangerous is the 21st century going to be?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. That is the sort of ultimate geopolitical question when you think about the world as multipolar. But the 21st century, because of globalization and integrated global economy, is not like the 19th century of European territorial powers competing over, you know, either in Europe or through their colonial possessions or over colonies. It's very different in two ways. One, it really is global. You have non-Western powers involved. China is a non-Western superpower. It is culturally distinct from European sort of rules, norms, and that historical pattern of polarity. And that creates the potential for misunderstanding, danger, and what you're alluding to. But right now, China is very dependent on a stable global economy. You know, its share of trade to GDP is apparently the highest in the entire world, which shows just how much it does depend on foreign capital inflows as well as exports around the world. So the current order as it is serves them very well. So there's less of a desire to destabilize that. But there can always be friction. And I think the question that you're asking really is where would the United States, China, and maybe Europe with European involvement or Russia or others be involved in a sort of a skirmish that could lead to World War III? Because, of course, no power has ever ceded, you know, sort of ceded its top dog status gracefully. So would it be Taiwan? Is it going to be something in the Arabian Sea? Is it if Kazakh oil, which flows in multiple directions, becomes tight? And there are these potential flashpoints. I can't pick any one and say, World War III, that's where it's happening. You heard it here first. But I am saying that if you believe that the world is flat and that just because we have economic interdependence, therefore there won't be any political calculations by which conflict would serve one party or the other, that would be very naive.
Congratulations. You used to be one of us, and now you're up
still
there.
Tomorrow night, I'll...
Thanks so much for being here. I just was curious about, I mean, many of us in this room have traveled to many different countries, and you come back with what might be a great book and some ideas, but how did you do this? I mean, you had a hypothesis about what you were going to find when you went out? Were there surprises? How much time were you in a particular country when you said, okay, I have enough information, now I'm going to go to another country? I mean, I'm sure you had fun, but What were some of your anxieties?
It was a lot of work, too. But There are definitely two things in mind in terms of hypotheses. One was this notion of how can people say that China is on top, Europe's on top, America's on top, and it all be true at the same time. So this notion that there really are multiple imperial centers of gravity, as I call them, really. These are the emerging imperial systems, you know, or ways of life that people are looking to in the world, and they are having the most influence everywhere. That, to me, seemed pretty sort of solid as something to sort of go on and explore. The other one was this notion of second world countries being sort of, you know, divided, globalization really accelerating the pace of this creation of winners and losers within countries, and it ultimately being destabilizing in all these places that we call emerging markets. You never know where a market's going to crash, where there's going to be a coup or whatever any given day or week, and it's often it's in this second world. And so it seemed to me that globalization has a lot to do with that. So those are the two things in my mind, and I sort of set out to explore them. I did pick the countries that I thought were most important and spend the most time in those. Apologies to anyone who's from Bulgaria. I spent one day in Bulgaria. I spent well over a month in Turkey and in Egypt. And, you know, the methodology, as I said, was just sort of aesthetic, you know, sort of gather information, material, talk to people. Obviously, I did tons of research in advance, went in with a long list of questions for anyone and everyone who would talk to me, from prime ministers to waitresses and taxi drivers. And those are all the kinds of people I talked to, journalists. But I didn't leave any place until I felt like I just kind of had the story, and that it wasn't really going to change from any more conversations. And that was how I decided. I had, you know, sort of a one-way plane ticket into a region, like a continent, and a ticket out months later. And that's what I did each time, basically. So it's not a great answer in terms of a rigorous structure, but I think if I had one, I don't think it would have been I don't think a scientific book is a better book necessarily, because you may try and force your impressions into a theory rather than first gathering the material and then deciding what it all means. But the two things I was thinking about, the two hypotheses, did more or less, you know, sort of bear themselves out over the course of the travel. Yeah.
Well, congratulations, Parag. As someone who was watching you as you were writing this book, it's really great to be here tonight on this night. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, when you look at these second world countries, one of the things we're seeing is economic reforms that are spurring growth. Mm-hmm. And the growth that is being spurred is kind of benefiting this sort of layer of business elites at the top, which is creating disparities that did not exist in the past. And so we're starting to see kind of the rise of these, you know, populist narratives emerging in many of these second world countries. Tell me what you saw in that regard. And because when we think of populism, we think of Hugo Chavez to some extent, we think of Ahmadinejad in Iran, but we also, we're starting to see this populism arising in the second world. And how big an issue do you think that's going to be?
You know, I think it's significant because, you know, business elites may want to integrate a country with the global economy. And I mentioned Egypt earlier. That's a country which, as you also know, the business elites are at the forefront of saying, we need to join the WTO. We need to be integrated. That's the best way to get investment and create jobs. But meanwhile, the lag between that and the narrative for the majority of the population, which is this government is corrupt, it's not doing anything for us, you know, get rid of the bastards, is also quite prominent as well. And again, the tension is, how is it going to play out? You know, one thing I forgot to say is that no matter how much time I spent in a country, one sort of strange thing or common denominator that I came away with was I just didn't know, even though I felt like I had my story that as I was going to tell it here, there's not a single place of all these countries where I think I could safely predict, even after having spent a lot of time there, what they're going to be like in 5 years' time. Will they have made it to the first world? Will they have collapsed? You know, I really don't know about any of these. And that's this knife's edge kind of situation that all these countries are in because of the stratification, as you're saying. So populist narratives are just one competitor fighting to figure out and define what each of these countries, you know, really, really are. In some countries, it'll win out, like in Venezuela. And indeed, the business elites were a scapegoat there for sure for Chavez and continue to be. And he gets a lot of mileage out of that. In other cases, you know, the narrative can attempt to be just sort of anti-American in Iran, for example. They're out to get us kind of thing. That works in some places, too. So there's a variety of messages and narratives out there. But I find that it's not just a winner camp and a loser camp. There's no less than 5 or 6 different constituencies, businesses, government elites, the military. So look at Pakistan or look at Egypt, look at Turkey, you know, where civil society wants one thing, politicians want to do another, Islamist parties want to do another thing, the military has its own ambitions, and so forth. So very complicated, more than just one narrative, actually, more than one kind of populism. Mm-hmm.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Again. I got my copy.
Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.